Hi, it's so nice to finally meet you. I know, this place is wonderful. The atmosphere is just fantastic. Oh, a little bit about myself. Okay, I've got a black cat. Her name is Blair, for obvious reasons. And she's really great, super cute, but she bites way too hard and way too often. There is a record of how much that cat loves me on my hand. I've got a collection of about 200 laser discs. I don't even watch laser discs that often. I just like having them. Even the art is so impressive to me. How often do you get to see square movie art? Okay, and what else? Oh, here's a big one. Even though I am obsessed with film and talk about it all the time, while I did go to college, I didn't go to college to study movies. I went to study books. When I first started going to school, I didn't know how much movies would mean to me. Sure, I had seen Star Wars and the Avengers, and had fond memories of watching movies with my friends as a teenager and with my dad while I was a child. But at that point, I hadn't found that cinema would be one of the great sources of meaning and consolation in my life. Now, movies mean everything to me. But when I was 20 years old, I wanted to study the written literature of the world. In some ways, I wish I would have studied cinema at university. I might have been able to make a better, more detailed podcast faster had I known more about the subject to begin with. And there are also topics that I just don't know very much about. My wife, who did study film at university, can run circles around me. Sure, I do know quite a bit about all of the stuff I research for this show. I put, 30 or 40 hours of work into each episode. But if you want to talk about the history and significance of martial arts filmmaking in East Asia, I promise it's her you want to talk to, not me. At least not yet. I have faith that I'll get there. All of that acknowledged, I think everything that I learned by studying literature in college has been really helpful for me here. For one thing, I learned how to write, which is sort of the basis of what I do now. But I think just as important, the critical practice of reading books and watching movies have a surprising amount of overlap. And a lot of what I learned in my best classes has been really helpful here. As I've been doing research on Italian futurism, which leads into Italian fascism, and the work of D.W. Griffith, whose most important movies have had an astonishingly negative impact on the world, many of the things that I learned while lugging around a Norton anthology of British literature have been extremely helpful to contextualize and understand these movies. While researching and writing for these two subjects in particular, I found myself looking back to my time at school on a topic called cultural production. For me, it's been extremely helpful, so I wanted to share it with you. The only problem is, I don't have any books about it, and I don't feel confident enough in my own memory to do it justice, so I decided to place a call.
Jacob, how are you?
The voice you just heard is Melissa Favara, a professor at Clark College in Vancouver, Washington, and the teacher of one of the most impactful classes I've ever taken. It was in her 19th century British literature class that I first heard the term cultural artifact. It's one of the most basic ways of understanding and talking about literature, and in our case, talking about movies. I asked Professor Favara to define the term. She started with just a piece of it. What is an artifact?
The word artifact is one of my favorite words, and it simply means something that has been created by human people, right? By human hands. It's been made.
Great. Now we just have to understand the word cultural. And you would think by adding cultural onto cultural artifact, it would narrow the term. But surprisingly, it doesn't.
Anything we make is made within a cultural context.
So in other words, when you're looking at something somebody has made, it can tell you about the culture that that person was participating in.
Like cultural artifact, we think of anything that has like a communicative content, right? You know, so a newspaper ad is a cultural artifact because it's made in a context and it betrays a cultural context.
This is why archaeologists get so excited about finding toys in Aztec ruins or a little bit of writing on a clay pot in Greece. Hopefully, by looking at those artifacts, researchers can understand more about the cultural factors that inspired their creation. And that's really cool, but so far we're still looking at everything ever made ever. Because what we are most interested in this show is movies, let's try to narrow that definition at least a little bit.
So it's anything that's created to make a communication of any kind within a human setting.
A communication, including a story as told in a narrative film, or an idea as communicated by a documentary.
But of course, anything that's made, any act of communication, happens within a setting or context. And so when we think about cultural production, we think about ways that things that are made by people who live in context, it can both mirror that cultural context and also shape it. How does this thing state and reiterate or reinscribe the norms of its time? And how does it potentially push back against or critique?
You can look at every movie this way. In what ways does the film reinscribe the dominant culture it was created in, and in what ways does it push back against it? Take, for example, the 1982 film Tootsie, directed by Sidney Pollack. The movie clearly reflects socially normative gender roles as they existed in the United States in the early 1980s. The comedy of the film is based on the tension of the protagonist, a man, pretending to be a woman so that he can better succeed in his career. The film just wouldn't work if it didn't assume that the audience watching it understood the gender roles it would be playing with. Thus, it reflects them. However, it also critiques them. Showing the male protagonist the harmful effects of the sexual advances that the women in the film accept as a matter of course, the unfortunate and unjust reality of being a woman, seen primarily as a sexual commodity in a world dominated by men. Thus, it critiques the very culture it reflects. It's a particularly interesting cultural artifact because of this. There are many movies that do this excellently. Think of the 2018 Spike Lee film Black Klansman, which is a cultural artifact that reflects and critiques roles of race and gender as they exist in the United States. Or, in another favorite movie, the 1968 film Death by Hanging, directed by Nasagi Oshima, doing the same thing in Japan. All of the movies that we just mentioned, these cultural artifacts, can tell us something about the culture that they are specifically trying to change. This certainly isn't always the case. The Wizard of Oz, I would argue, is an artifact that does an awful lot of reflecting, but very little critiquing. The same thing with Cinderella, The Adventures of Robin Hood, and The Chronicles of Narnia. Obviously, all of those movies have nuance to them, but I hope you take my point. And there is another part of this that we haven't really talked about yet, either. We've seen reflections of cultural values in artifacts, and we have also seen artifacts that critique the cultural context that they were created in. But there is a third function that cultural artifacts can have: reinforcement. More than a mere reflection of societal fears or values, this form of communicative artifact seeks to deepen those values and fears, planting them ever more deeply in the hearts of the people who interact with this artifact. Professor Favara gave this as an example.
Early 80s, during the sort of last gasps of the Cold War, we had such a rash of film and television in the United States in which Russians were the villains. We had this constant portrayal of, like, the Russians were coming to get us. And there's a kids movie, like a YA kind of movie called Red Dawn, you know, where the Russians have taken over the United States and it falls to these teenagers to, like, to push back against, you know, and fight against the Russians. And those were all, like, very cynical, transactional pieces of art that were created to capitalize on and reinscribe the really unfounded fear of imminent extinction of our culture.
Before we move on, I just want to make sure that you know that it's not only fears and anxieties that can be reinforced through cultural artifacts. Values can be as well. Take one of my honest-to-goodness favorite movies of all time, Frank Capra's 1946 film, It's a Wonderful Life. Pretty much the whole point of that movie is to reinforce the normative Christian and family values that were considered standard issue for the white majority of its day. That doesn't necessarily make it a bad or an evil movie, nor does it automatically make it a perfectly moral or good one. But it does mean that we should examine it as an artifact of its cultural context rather than simply accepting it at face value, in much the same way that one would try to examine the Iliad or the Odyssey in their historical and cultural context. That can be harder with movies because they're so much more recent and we can sometimes feel more viscerally connected to them, but it's just as important. I'm bringing all of this up now because I feel like it's important to recognize and understand this concept before we get to the movies that are some of the most important cultural artifacts of modern history. Next week, we're going to cover the movie that was designed to reinforce the worst parts of American culture to its intended audience. The Birth of a Nation holds up and enshrines the racist fear and hatred of the other, claims that acts of major racial violence are not only historically precedented, but were and are completely necessary, and practically begs the ostensibly white audience of the 1910s to go and take action. We'll talk about it in more detail next week, but this kind of reinforcement resulted in the deaths and torture of unknowable numbers of Black American citizens and the reestablishment of one of the most prominent terrorist groups of the 20th century. The Birth of a Nation is more than a movie, as all movies are. They are cultural artifacts. And by seeking to understand them in the cultural and temporal context in which they were created, hopefully it will give us the tools we need to best understand them and interact with them now. In the case of The Birth of a Nation, we'll be examining why it was considered so important, so marvelous, such a great work of art then, and why we all should recognize it as a vicious piece of dangerous propaganda now, even if it was also excellent in its technical achievement. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. Thank you for listening to this special bonus episode of The History of Film. And a special thank you to Melissa Favara, who is both an excellent professor and a great person to interview. When I originally contacted Professor Favara, I was planning on talking with her about how Italian futurism and Italian fascism can both be seen as cultural artifacts that reflect similar concerns and values, and while I do think that would have been cool, I think having this discussion on cultural artifacts before we cover The Birth of a Nation is going to be more helpful for everyone. If you'd like to email me, you can contact me at historyoffilmpodcast@gmail.com. And if you want to visit the show's website, you could do so at historyoffilmpodcast.com, though it is under construction. Thank you so much for listening, and join me next week for another exciting full episode of The History of Film.